Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, both of them familiar voices on the show, and both, by coincidence, political scientists based in Philadelphia. George Ciccariello Marr, who teaches at Drexel University and is author of We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution, will talk about the anti-government protests in that country. And Adolf Reed, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, will talk about his article in the March issue of Harper's on the sad decline of the American left. First up, George Ciccariello Marr. George was on Behind the News last April talking about his book, We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution, published by Duke University Press. One of the crucial points that George makes in his book is that the treatment of the state versus popular movements as some sort of binary opposition is the wrong way to understand what's been going on in Venezuela since Hugo Chavez took power in 1999. Popular movements made his government possible, pushed it to the left during his tenure in office, and acted as a check on the tendency of states to abuse power. At the same time, state action under Chavez opened up spaces for popular movements to operate. Whether this productive dynamic can continue under Chavez's successor, Nicolas Maduro, is an open question. But George's analysis is an important contribution not only to how to think about what's been going on in Venezuela, but more broadly about transformative politics in general. Given the demonstrations against the Maduro government in Venezuela over the last few weeks, I thought this was an excellent time to give George a ring. George Ciccariello Marr. Welcome, George. You've certainly attracted some hostility on the internet lately. A bohemian pederast is one of the few things we can say on the radio. What's upset these people so?
Well, what we've got to understand when we're talking about especially the more conservative sectors of Venezuelan society and exiles, especially to the United States, is that, you know, this is very much like the what are called the gusanos of Cuba, the extremely right-wing, quasi sort of fascistic, anti-democratic, terrorist elements of these countries. And so that's not, you know, those aren't the only people calling me names. Certainly, of course, on Twitter, one rarely has any idea who is actually behind the handle. But this is the kind of person that's being, you know, really radically mobilized by this. And you see this, I think, in similar ways on the way that if anyone caught the story yesterday about the retired Venezuelan general, who's an incredibly right-wing figure that has done utterly insane things in the past, is now, you know, taking it up a notch by, you know, engaging in an armed standoff on the roof of his house in Venezuela with a machine gun, claiming that the Cubans are there to arrest him. And of course, he is being investigated because two Venezuelan motorcyclists have been beheaded by barbed wire hung near these opposition barricades. And it turns out that he had tweeted out the suggestion that this be done, which was retweeted more than 2,000 times just as of yesterday.
Okay, so what inspired this recent round of uprising or proto-coup activity or whatever you want to call it? What would you call it to start with? But what inspired this round of violence and protest?
Well, concretely speaking, we're talking about protests that began in the student sector, protests that have, especially on the surface of it, have very legitimate grievances with regard to the economic scarcity and shortages, and also this question of insecurity, which is incredibly, you know, incredibly serious in Venezuela. The murder rate is in some ways sky high. But there are a couple of things to, and sort of provisos to add to this. One is that the movement in the streets does not really, to put it straightforwardly, doesn't come from those sectors who are most affected by these questions. You know, people are suffering. People are, you know, having to go to a couple of supermarkets to get especially things like wheat flour sometimes. Everyone heard about the toilet paper, the sort of, you know, brief shortage of toilet paper and these kind of things. But economic shortages are, you know, affect those who do not have the resources to get around them, and the poor especially, except for the fact that there are government sponsored supermarkets that when they don't have shortages also have, you know, very low prices. And with regard to crime, I saw someone on Twitter say something about violence doesn't discriminate, but we all know, I think, perfectly well that it does, and that those who are killed in street crime and drug crime and you know, mafia crime are almost always the lowest level, of the poor in the streets. But sort of to get it back toward these protests, these are the questions raised by the protesters. But it's very unconvincing to me that this explains why this is happening now. And what does explain it is the fact that, or at least explains the fact that these have blown up into a sort of national level thing, is the maneuvering behind the scenes among the opposition. Because it was in the December elections, recall there were local elections in December in Venezuela, that the Chavistas largely did very well in, and the opposition was disappointed with their result. It was after these elections that, on the one hand, Enrique Capriles, who had run against both Chavez and Maduro and lost, decided and realized, actually kind of rightly, that there's no way for the opposition to become a majority if it doesn't actually attempt to win Chavistas, which means to attempt to win the poor, and that this would require a very different strategy in the future. And at the same time that Capriles is taking this tack, those who were already frustrated with his leadership and also just really interested in being leaders in their own right began to break to the right. These are the people who have thrown themselves behind the protests and escalated the protest and pressed them toward the national scale and pressed them toward hashtags like La Salida, the exit of Nicolás Maduro. And they're, of course, embodied in Leopoldo López, who is now in custody for things like inciting violence.
What's been happening in Venezuela is often described as a revolution, but it's not like the Venezuelan rich have been exactly expropriated, have they?
No, if anything, in many senses, this is a very patient revolutionary process. To the extent that actually leftist critics say, well, it's not really a revolution yet. We hope that maybe it will get there, but it's a process that has been developing spaces that push toward revolution. But the overall, if you want to summarize the Venezuelan government's overall strategy over the past 15 years, I call it much more of a war of position. There are moments of clashing, there are moments of conflict, and these moments have led, like the coup, for example, the oil lockout in 2003, these have led to important gains. But overall, in between these moments of conflict, what the government does is to build alternative institutions, to recognize, for example, social and communal property in the Constitution while not prohibiting private property, to, encourage different forms of social and communal production while not, for the most part, or without very good reason, expropriating capitalists. And when they expropriate, it's almost always been, I'm pretty sure it actually always has been, with compensation. So this has not been, as you put it, this has not been the sort of vast and sudden expropriation of capital.
Now let's just for a moment talk about some of the grievances that people would have. The crime, what's behind this?
It's on the one hand, it's important to say it's nothing new. There was a huge crime, or murder spike in the late 1990s before Chavez came to power. But at the same time, after this dropped, it dropped in the early 2000s. There was a dramatic increase, although it's kind of unclear at the present moment where we're at. An opposition blogger has written a really good piece coming out to say that actually the numbers that everyone is quoting, I think it's, I'm pretty sure it's something like 25,000 murdered last year, is actually a projection that's based on very, very dubious, data. And so there are reasons to think that maybe that isn't the number. Maybe the murder rate has actually been stable for a couple of years and possibly declined. Although, again, this is all, very difficult to speculate. But regardless, we're talking about some of the most dangerous places on Earth. And I think the reasons for it, one is the fact that we need to understand the background, and this is the fact that the police in Venezuela were historically part of the problem and not part of the solution. And in other words, they were involved in the drug trade, they were corrupt, they were themselves violent, and this is well known. There's no real question about this. The second is that here is a government that comes to power on the basis of an opposition to state violence. Now, this puts us in an interesting situation because on the one hand, the government needs to deal with violence, but on the other hand, its hands are tied in ways that, for example, the government of, say, the narco-fascist Alvaro Uribe in Colombia, he could essentially just ethnically cleanse out, anyone who he thought was participating in violent crime and he would get away with it. But the Venezuelan government cannot become a repressive government toward crime. And in part because the radical base of the process insists that, that this be done in a very specific way. So what has it done? I think maybe the government didn't realize that the problem was going to get as serious as it has. And so didn't respond quickly enough. When it did, it began by trying to purge the traditional police forces, which I'm sure had some effect, but certainly not sufficient effect. And then a couple of years later, and this now is only very recently, it actually built and established a Bolivarian national police force, kind of centralizing the police under one broad rubric, and has begun to train these police in a very different way, a more humanistic way. What's funny is now, of course, you hear people saying, well, these new police, they're not tough enough. And so, you know, you run into this inevitable tension. Another important factor to point out, though, is that part of the tensions around crime and around the demands to resolve it and around the different ways to approach it have led to actually in the, you know, after a couple of years in which the prison population in Venezuela declined, it shot up dramatically running up to 2010, 2011. And there's been kind of a prison crisis over the last few years. The impact of this on crime is absolutely undeniable. Everyone, you know, refers to the prisons as a university, you know, of malandraje, of creating delinquents, and that's all the prisons do. And so the more people you've got cycling through these prisons, becoming part of gang organizations or of mafias that are not confined to the prison, but are actually kind of sort of large capitalist enterprises, if you understand it properly, these are a huge part of the problem. And these mafias are connected to elites in Venezuela as well as in Colombia. These are huge business. And this is something that's flourished over the past few years.
And now the other issue, shortages. Why would an oil exporting country have such a problem with shortages of basic materials?
Well, the first reason that an oil country would specifically is because one of the most destructive aspects of the oil economy is that it hinders and provides a disincentive to domestic production. It makes it much easier to just import goods, to import all the food, than to actually produce things domestically. And this is part of what the government has been struggling against: how to rebuild a productive base, not even intermediate goods necessarily, but just agriculture. You know, Venezuela at one point was importing 90% of its food. And this is, you know, this is in a country that's capable of growing, you know, capable of growing a great deal of food. And so while there's been an expansion of that production, this agricultural capacity, it hasn't really kept pace. And what it hasn't kept pace with, here's a second factor, is that, you know, Venezuelan caloric intake over the past decade has increased dramatically, doubled, according to some measures. And so, you know, the fact that people are eating so much more is cutting into the ability of the actual productive apparatus to keep up.
Now, that means that people are not getting fat. It means that formerly hungry people are getting fed.
Are getting fed, yes, for the first time, yeah, in recent decades, actually having access to food. And a lot of this is, again, still imported food. And this places a great, you know, fiscal strain on the government, but also on the exchange, you know, situation. The question of exchange is very complex, and I'm certainly not an expert on it. But this is really where I think a lot of the shortages have come in recently. And my understanding of it is that earlier in 2013, actually at a very, it was terribly timed, there was an attempt to, you know, there's a devaluation and also an attempt to cut to sort of limit the access of some companies to U.S. dollars at the official rate. And the reason is because all oil money comes, you know, to the government in dollars. The government then becomes responsible for dispersing these dollars to all private corporations that want to import goods. And the temptation, especially once you get something like a huge gap in the black market exchange rate, is that this money is going to be processed through the black market in what is simply financial speculation as opposed to actual importing. And secondly, that what will be imported will be sold at a rate that, you know, is exaggerated and then exacerbates the question of inflation. So my sense is that there was an attempt to restrict these dollars, which was very clumsily executed and led to some very serious shortages, especially in certain goods. And that this sort of clumsiness in how to disperse these dollars and while simultaneously cracking down on currency speculation has been one of the Achilles' heels of the government over the past year. Now, this was really hurting the government through the summer, but then what happened later in 2013, as some of you may remember, is that the Maduro government made a very astute political decision to really get on the offensive with this when, for example, it sent the National Guard to occupy certain companies that were accused of essentially getting official dollars at the official government rate. In other words, basically subsidized dollars from the government, buying goods to import and then selling them at the unofficial rate, essentially. And so, you know, increasing the price of things so that their profit margin would have been something like tenfold or even a hundredfold. So, you know, the government sent in essentially troops at one point, but used the Consumer Protection Agency under a very radical, a very radical leader at the time to do radical oversight and to go into stores, slash their prices, and allow people to buy things. And in this, you also had the participation of grassroots organizations that sprung up to go check prices everywhere to make sure that, you know, local people weren't hoarding food. That's another problem, is hoarding, especially when it comes to basic food items. And so you had a moment in which the political will emerged to take more radical action against this. And this is, you know, this is something that unfortunately hasn't necessarily been followed through on, but it represented kind of a, not only a moment of hope and political excitement about Maduro, but also an alternative way, right? Not just a technocratic or from above way of dealing with these problems, but really how is it that we incorporate the grassroots into dealing with these questions?
I'm speaking with George Ciccarello Marr, who teaches at Drexel University in Philadelphia and is the author of the book, We Created Chavez. Speaking of the grassroots, you've written and talked about the creative tension that's existed between popular groups, some of them armed, and the government. What's their role been in recent events?
In recent events over the past couple of weeks? Well, it's been very, very controversial because you have the opposition crying foul and saying, I mean, I'm not even the opposition, but just lots of people on Twitter saying these armed thugs, these colectivos, they're behind all this violence. And even saying, and this is still being repeated, but even as I mentioned, is the very clear death of Basil da Costa that seems to have been carried out by a official government, someone, an official of the government who happened to be, this one was in uniform actually, and some of the other ones there were in plain clothes, but were also state officials. And so it doesn't fit this script that it's these, you know, paramilitary colectivos. And the colectivos have actually not really been involved in, as far as we can tell, much of anything, except possibly in this shooting in Valencia that led to a death. But what this represents really is the bogeyman of the opposition. And it's something that is consistent through recent history. It's something that's about race and class and mobility at the same time, this fear of these motorcycle hordes who are taking over our rich part of the city. And so even in calmer times, you know, rich Venezuelans will tweet out pictures saying, oh no, there's motorizados in this part of Altamira, everybody should be careful. If they see anyone with red shirts or slightly dark skin, they essentially consider them to be part of these colectivos. And so it's become a sort of pejorative term of slander. But the reality is that these colectivos, which is a broad term that encompasses a whole bunch of things, some of them are and have been armed militia elements that emerged as revolutionary self-defense organizations against police and drug violence in the 80s and 90s. And so these are actually really popular self-defense organizations that furthermore have played the most revolutionary role in this process. It's these organizations that more than any other defended the Chavez government during the coup and returned it to power. There's a great interview with a colectivo leader the other day who was saying, listen, we're willing to use violent means to defend the constitutional order. And that was how he put it. It's a very interesting way to understand this tension.
What is the contribution of the disappearance of the very strong personality of Chavez?
I think people are realizing, even people like myself, that the role that Chavez played, maybe we underestimated it at some point. That's not to say that, again, the process was about him as opposed to the movements, but, you know, he did play such a powerful centering and unifying role in this process. And that's what's being disrupted at this point. And not only that, you have Chavez, the image, being reincorporated by these opposition sectors into the sort of glorious history of the nation without actually remembering what Chavez stood for. In other words, you have the opposition now coming out and saying, same people who were attacking Chavez previously, after he died, they say, well, Chavez was fine, but this Maduro, he's terrible and we should get rid of him. And so what this does is really to defang the history of Chavez and to turn him into an image of class collaboration, when in fact he was an image of class combat.
There have been rather ultra-leftists and anarchists who've been talking lately about how Maduro et al. Are the sort of modern reincarnations of Stalin. What's your evaluation of their contribution to the discourse?
Well, I mean, their contribution to the discourse is, I think, measurable. Their contribution to anything like the revolutionary process in Venezuela is minimal to negligible, in the sense that there is really no substantial ultra-left of any sense that is outside of the Bolivarian process. And this is actually where the differences, I don't think this is a universal situation. The differences between Venezuela and places like Bolivia and Ecuador are very significant. It's quite literally the case that there are almost no revolutionary movements that are outside of the process. And what this means is that the understanding that the strategic objectives of maintaining the Bolivarian government in power and forcing it to help create spaces that then can be occupied by revolutionary movements and pressed from below is something that almost everyone agrees on. And then you have, of course, these smallish anarchist groups, which have, you know, unfortunately have their voice amplified by international anarchism when they shouldn't, because they simply aren't even of the, you know, of the level of many of the international or U.S. anarchists that are supporting their voice. And essentially, they've taken a sort of pox on both your houses approach to the question, even tending in some cases toward supporting the protests, because they viewed the Chavez government, now the Maduro government, as kind of more of the same, really just more of the oil economy and almost like a state capitalism, and which again is not, you know, there's no question that there's a huge element of that there, but the question is what process brings us beyond that. And so these are people who quite literally, if you look at some of these anarchist statements, say we are not politically active in any of this. We're sort of bystanders watching it all happen. And then there are, and I'll be writing something on this soon, then there are actual anarchists who take an actual position of revolutionary struggle. And what they have said is very interesting. You know, it says, we do not support any states, but we understand that the revolution is a social and popular revolution. In other words, it's a revolution in which the masses of people will need to participate. And therefore, we're not willing to give up on a government that is at the very least preventing us from being slaughtered and going to jail and closing down spaces for participation, which is exactly what would happen if this government were overthrown or even defeated in elections.
Yeah, this is an important point to underscore, which is something you talk about a lot, is that this is not a pure state-led process. There are really an awful lot of involvement of popular organizations that are pushing agendas and keeping the state honest.
Absolutely, which is not to say, I'm incredibly suspicious of the state. I think there is, especially in a petro state, there is a massive degree of inertia that sets in, so that if you leave the state to its own devices, it will fulfill precisely, you know, this fantasy of the anarchists and become, you know, this more of the same. But that is not what's happening, precisely because the movements have been so bound to the process and operated autonomously from it that they've been continuously able to radicalize it. And this is evident in the fact that when Chavez was elected in 98, in the campaign in 98 and in 99. It wasn't simply rhetorical. He was very much a moderate in a lot of ways, with some radical sympathies, but his program and his understanding of the world was that here's how we approach moderate change. But as a result of the conflicts with the opposition and as a result of the press from below, from the movements, it became very clear to him as well that there is no half-stepping when it comes to this kind of a process, and that it really needs to be a bet and a wager on the ability of the people to participate and drive it as a protagonist.
To what extent is the hand of Langley involved in the recent uprising?
That's a good question. I would be the last one to want to minimize U.S. imperial intervention into Venezuela, because it's constant, because we know perfectly well that Obama's position toward Venezuela, especially with Hillary Clinton at the State Department, was exactly the same and has been exactly the same as George Bush's, you know, approach to Venezuela. If anything, Obama has been even more open about the fact that he continues to fund this opposition, regardless of the fact that it's a lot of the people who engaged in an undemocratic coup in the past. And so the U.S. interest is to get rid of this government. This is perfectly clear. What's less clear is what's going on the ground, and that's partly because we won't find out until afterward. But my guess is that this is a terrible decision being made by a ferocious and short-sighted Venezuelan opposition, and that the U.S. is throwing its support behind it and will throw its support behind it without being sort of the master puppet, you know, the puppet master pulling all of the strings. So these reactionary sectors in Venezuela are perfectly capable of making these kind of decisions on their own and of attempting to overthrow this government, hoping that they've got the support of the U.S. And they do have the support of the U.S. That was perfectly clear after the election.
All right. So should we be despairing of the future of this Venezuelan experiment, or do you think they'll pull out of this?
Well, I think, this gets to kind of the broader methodological question as revolutionaries is that, the moment we despair is the moment that we're essentially, allowing what we fear to come into reality. And so despair is not exactly, I don't think, the best approach. But the point is to understand that if we The Venezuelan government needs to stabilize certain questions. And, you know, certainly on the macroeconomic front, certainly with regard to crime and violence. It needs to, as a, in the medium term, continue to win elections. But then beyond that, it's really going to be a question of the expansion and consolidation of these popular organs across society. There are more than 40,000 communal councils. These are coming together in what are called communes, which are broader associations of communal councils in which an entire area and region can be completely communally run, directly democratically, productively, with the incorporation of, both worker-owned factories, state-owned factories, and, and cooperative, organizations. And then you can really begin to build the basis for a real socialism that isn't as subject to these sort of importation questions quite so much. And it's going to be a push from below that makes this possible. Now, it happens to be that the commune minister in Venezuela is a very revolutionary person at this point, and it would be devastating to see the communal project pulled back by moderate elements within Chavismo that don't want to be too provocative or that don't want to, that don't want to undermine the other existing institutional structures. But at the same time, the pressure is going to come from below, and it's going to come from these hundreds of thousands of people who are not in the streets today, certainly protesting, while they are frustrated with economic questions, while they are, worried about crime. Precisely those people who think that the question is not so much how can we talk to and negotiate with the capitalists so that they'll give us the things that we need, and more how do we just move right beyond them entirely.
That was George Ciccarello Amar, author of We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution, and assistant professor of political science at Drexel University in Philadelphia. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Paleosonic from Brian Eno's 2010 album, Small Craft on a Milk Sea. Continuing the thread of Philadelphia-based political scientists, next up is Adolf Reed, who's been on this show many times. Adolf, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, has an article, Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals in the March issue of Harper's. Among his points, we must begin with the admission that there is essentially no American left, though there are, of course, leftists of many stripes. Some people have criticized Adolf's article for not offering more practical suggestions on what to do, which puts me in mind of this gem of a quote from T.W. Adorno. The question, what is to be done, as an automatic reflex to every critical thought before it is fully expressed, recalls the gesture of someone demanding your papers. Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. I was reading just the other day that the problem with Obama is that his presidency doesn't have a story. Is that the problem with Obama?
Oh, gee. Well, I suppose that could be one of them. I always thought it had a story, though, and it's a story that's a sequel, actually, to the first volume of democratic neoliberalism that began with Clinton. So I'd say, yeah, it does have a story. So I will defend President Obama against the charge that his administration doesn't have a story.
You say in the Harper's piece that he used his identity as a substitute for an actual ideology. Tell us about that.
It came through in a lot of ways during the campaign and in the ways that he's governed and actually going back to the beginning of his political career, which I wouldn't expect anyone else to know. I just happened to be there to see it. But he's always kind of given us, and this is true in his two books too. They're both the memoirs. Give us a sense of who he is as a person, how he's evolved, what his background is, that vaguely sort of stands in for a politics, takes the place of a politics. I noted when I was working on this that in an interview with James Traub, it's not often that I cite James Traub in a positive way, but a year before the election, Obama said, and I'll quote him here if you don't mind, "I think that if you can tell people we have a president in the White House who still has a grandmother living in a hut on the shores of Lake Victoria and has a sister who's half Indonesian married to a Chinese Canadian, then they're going to think that he may have a better sense of what's going on in our lives and in our country, and they'd be right," end quote. You know, at least until the first drone comes in.
Well, that doesn't sound all that different in some ways from Newt Gingrich saying race in America today is Tiger Woods.
No, I guess in a way it's not all that different. And I see that Obama was, there's another brouhaha about Obama and multiculturalist claims, I guess, that's popping off now. Ted Nugent apparently called him a subhuman mongrel in one of his fascist rants at a gun show. And I saw just this morning, actually, that Nugent was interviewed on CNN and given an occasion to talk himself off the ledge, basically. And part of his exoneration or his attempt at exonerating himself, was a claim that he was referring to a reference that Obama made on The View, I believe, where he described himself as a mongrel and said that most African Americans are mongrels and most white Americans are also mongrels. It's just that. So there's a sense that in which the discourse, a narrative of racial transcendence or transcendence of racial bad times, has always been a part of Obama's packaging. Look, it sort of worked. I mean, in the 2008 campaign, even many people outside the U.S. and not just in French cafes where intellectuals hang out, but in much of what used to be called the Third World, and even in hotspots where you'd expect that people's antipathies or mistrust of the U.S. would run more deeply than the epidermal features of the person who holds the office of the presidency. There was, as I recall, a lot of expression of enthusiasm at Obama's election, hopes that because he had Third World roots of multiple complex fluid sorts, that he would be more understanding, whatever understanding means. But I mean, yet again, right? It's like consistent with a feature of our national politics, right? The disconnection of individuals from substantive political and certainly the military programs.
Well, what have we gotten for what David Dinkins used to call this gorgeous mosaic?
I mean, I think that what we've gotten is, and I think that Obama has sort of completed this transformation too, that we have, my father used to insist, when I was a youngster, that we had one party in America. It was a property party and it had two wings. That wasn't original with him either, obviously. But I think now what we would have to say is that we have a singular, if not bipartisan, neoliberal party, one wing of which is committed to neoliberalism that attaches a high that value to a kind of equality of opportunity that's embodied or that's enacted in discourse and practice of multiculturalism and diversity, and another that's committed to neoliberalism that's appended with an active opposition to multiculturalism and diversity. And each side tries to mobilize an electoral base made up of those who are either for multiculturalism and diversity or those who are actively opposed to multiculturalism and diversity. And meanwhile, the 80 to 90% of policy decisions and courses of action that affect the 85 to 90% of the society most crucially, that there's a complete consensus on.
The Democrats and even the supporters on the left do have the advantage of pointing to a Republican Party that is quite insane and frightening. But on the other hand, the Democratic Party is kind of contentless and not non-inspiring.
Yeah, but insofar as it has content. I mean, like I mentioned this, you know, the Moyers interview, that as well as your article, so Obama gives this speech that, for which he's gotten a lot of props, because I think he mentioned inequality a couple of times, and said in the mode of Mr. Mackey on South Park that it's bad, okay, don't do inequality. But then, for all intents and purposes, he walked away from the podium and goes to strong arm congressional Dems to get behind Fast Track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership that would do horrible things for government's capacity to regulate you know, what some might call the excesses of capitalist market forces. And for him and for his wing of the Democratic Party, there's no contradiction. I mean, just as there's no contradiction in pursuit of approach to public education that's gutting public schools, firing public teachers. I just saw a couple of days ago that Newark, it looks like it's planning to lay off as many as 700 teachers from the public school system and replace them, around half of them at least, with TFA children. So, I mean, how can you talk about the injustice of economic inequality while at the same time pursuing social policy even that's directed at reducing living standards of people who work in public institutions across the board, and through outsourcing, the privatization in the case of education, the charterization, destroying the material foundation of this baseline of conventional, democratic voters in the interest of turning the public sector into a woodlot, basically, into the primeval forest.
What happened? I mean, 40, 50, 60 years ago, we had a substantial portion of the Democratic Party and its electoral base that was broadly social democratic, you might say. Now that has been reduced to near nothingness. What happened over these decades to make this happen?
Wow, boy. Well, I mean, that's a big question. I mean, there are a number of things that happened. I mean, you could start the meter of compromise or the meter of defeat running in the late 1940s, right? I mean, after the defeat of the Full Employment Bill in 1945, and not just passage of Taft-Hartley, though in some ways I think the worst or the gravest long-run consequences of Taft-Hartley may well have been what Nelson Lichtenstein has aptly described as forcing organized labor into geographical and an occupational archipelago, which then sort of reinforces the material foundation for the ideological construction of the notion of a middle class that has nothing to do with workers and with labor, but also the defeat or the terms of accommodation, right, that were available to the American version of a social democratic left after those defeats of the late 1940s hinged on acceptance of the trumping power of capital. It's kind of striking. I mean, I've been writing about this stuff, for a while now, and I've been struck at how even people like Reuther, who was a socialist, and Leon Kaiserling, who wasn't that but was a redistributivist liberal or had been, were the biggest boosters of defense-driven Cold War spending. In part because that was a compromise, right? The pursuit of endless economic growth as an alternative to actual redistribution. And then, what happens is everybody gets accustomed to it. All of the movements or the interest groups that were associated with left of center interests are kind of pressured / find ways to craft the interests or the practical understandings of the interests of the constituencies that they represent. That also fit within giving absolute priority to capitalist property rights. And then, it's a little simplistic, but once the nature of the game changes, late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s, and the bourgeoisie decides that they're not going to compromise anymore, we're no longer in a position to respond effectively.
I'm speaking with Adolf Reed, professor of political science at Penn and author of an essay in the March issue of Harper's on the long, slow surrender of the American left. Sometimes I'm just tempted to give up on politics entirely and retire to my easy chair and read lyric poetry and aesthetic theory, but assuming that we all don't do that, is there some way to turn this around?
Well, I think there are ways to try to turn it around, and there are ways to act like it's not necessary to try to turn it around. I think the latter is what's really hopeless. I mean, I think the first step, the necessary step, is to acknowledge that the left, as an institutionally meaningful force in American life, just does not exist. You know, I mean, there is no left. I mean, there are leftists, thank whatever, that there are still some of those around, as we would have recognized them 25 years ago. And there are, you know, I mean, obviously left institutions of one sort or another, I mean, organizations, publications, centers of discourse, but by and large, insofar as a left exists in America, it's and the interstices of more mainstream institutions. And I think that one of the reasons that, or one way that it can be useful to acknowledge that from the outset is that what follows from that acknowledgement is, first of all, kind of a demystification of practice, right? I mean, if protest politics is largely the creature of settled interest group regime, and if the settled interest group regime no longer exists, then protest politics is not going to be anywhere near as effective as it might have been in earlier times. And what that means then is that that helps explain why so much of our protest has taken on the form of an inward-looking pageantry over the last 20 years. And a lesson to take from that is that while it's necessary to engage to some degree in public acts like that, that's not movement building, and there's never been a way to build a movement, right? There've been means, just like elections, to express strength that's been created in the domain of social movement organizing. So acknowledging from the outside that we can have no influence on the direction of national politics at this point, and probably in the vast majority of cases, not on the direction of local politics either. Bill de Blasio and enthusiasm about him notwithstanding, that also tells us then that the task is to start trying to figure out how to begin building or rebuilding, for those who think we had one, the kind of left that might be able to develop the capacity to alter the terms of political debate. Now, I know I can anticipate a reaction coming from a number of different quarters, and to some extent it's an understandable one, that the moment is urgent. The moment of crisis is so urgent that we can't afford to disengage from practical politics here and now to build for something down the road. This is not the aftermath of the Canton uprising. But again, to those complaints, I'd have to say, well, the first thing I have to say is, all right, so slow down on the moralizing for a second. But also, that it doesn't have to be either or, right? I mean, like, we don't have to stop completely desist from taking stands against injustice. But it should be possible to do that to whatever extent people want to do it. And I do think, frankly, that's a personal existential choice as much as it is anything. But also to recognize the real task is to start trying to figure out how to connect people and tendencies who are politically serious to start trying to have quiet discussions among small groups of people about how strategically to go about trying to create a mass movement over time.
What about elections? There seems to be a disease of electoralism.
Oh my God! Yeah, I mean it's stunning. I don't know when it happened, but I think I first began to notice it in the mid '90s when it just seemed that everybody was freaking out about the need to have candidates for stuff, which was not the left I can remember. Growing up in, but I just don't think that there's anything that we can do in those, right? Other than to try to have to support the least worst option. Or the less worst option, since as a rule, there are going to be only two of them. And I want to be clear, because often people have trouble hearing this, that I'm not saying that electoral engagement is misguided or is a waste of time. I just want to try to put it in its proper perspective, and to recognize what it's possible for us, and by us again, I mean people with a commitment to left visions of a better society and of social transformation. The most you can do is to stop the bleeding. So in the sense of of trying to support the electoral options that promise to, if not reduce the amount of actual suffering experienced by actual people, at least to slow the pace at which the suffering deepens and is generalized, while at the same time understanding that's that's what you're doing, and at the same time trying to find ways to aggregate forces to fight a bigger fight on terms that we can define. And I want to say, in this regard too, that I think this was the main beef that I had with Obamamania, and I know you did, and others also, was not the idea of voting for the Democrat against the Republican. The fact is that once you get to that stage of things, that's kind of what there is to do, and there aren't any other options that mean much. And since we can't really have any influence on what the Democrat looks like, then it's going to be a Democrat who's a neoliberal Democrat, and that's what it is. But the problem was that people kept trying to make this more than that, right? You make the election of Barack Obama a much greater statement or an augury of the possibility of grand things to come that was in no way indicated by anything he had ever said or done in the entirety of his political career, and in fact was contraindicated once you started to look at where his material backing had come from the very beginning of his career in Chicago.
And finally, it seems to me, and I think you probably agree with this, that it seems much more fruitful for folks like us to organize around specific issues, single payer, living wage legislation, affordable housing things, a Green New Deal, things that are really specific and have a large potential constituency, rather than trying to get involved in electoral politics in great enthusiasm, because especially at the senior national level, the bourgeoisie has such a lock in those offices that we're not going to make any difference. But if you start pushing on these issues that have great potential appeal, at least, politicians might have to respond.
Well, I agree with you completely. And this is where I get to make the perverse point that I like to make so much, which is that actually, from the standpoint of progressive interests of various sorts, we got more from Richard Nixon than we got from Bill Clinton and Barack Obama combined. And it's not that Nixon liked us. In fact, I think he probably wished most of us weren't here at all. But it's that the nature of, the balance of political forces was such that there was still a significant enough left tendency with some institutional traction in American politics that Nixon understood that he needed to accommodate its existence. So, if you want to, right, if one wanted to, you could even say that, Clinton and Obama might have been better if they'd had better or more serious pressure from their left. I don't know. I'm not the confessor of either. And I think, frankly, I've understood them both to be douches. But your point is the correct point. And the way for us to have to generate the capacity to make the politicians of whatever party respond is precisely, as you say, to build the social forces around issues that actually, it's not just that the issues are right on their own, but the kind of issues that you talk about are those that can, or as you mentioned, are those that can, that have the potential to unite broadly within the population, and that affect most of the American public or most people in this country, when they wake up in the morning and when they go to bed at night. The things that they're concerned about and anxious about are things like affordable housing and quality education, having a pension, access to real health care, and so on, right? So,
and it would seem to do more to fight racism than 20 years of Tim Wise seminars ever could.
Absolutely. Because that's another fact of this, this is one of the bizarre things I find about, the various strains of what was once called, I guess they even call it something else now, identity politics on what's supposed to be the left, or anti-racist politics. It seems driven in all the more shrill ways by scouring the horizon of American life or even the globe to find instances that will attest to the persistence of deep racism or old school bigotry or whatever. When nobody ever said really that sort of racial animus has been overcome or could be entirely overcome. But the fact of the matter is that if you want to improve the social position of, you know, Black Americans, Latino Americans, other non-whites, the most effective way to do it, the biggest bang for the buck, would come from pursuing programs and goals that would reinforce the economic well-being and security of the vast majority of working Americans, because not only are the majority of those non-whites among, or do the majority of those non-whites fall into the the working class broadly construed, but even disproportionately so, according to the those who focus on racial disparity as the key metric of inequality. So yeah, that's definitely the way to do it.
That was Adolf Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of the article Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals in the March issue of Harper's. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more Brian Eno, this some of Juju Space Jazz from 1992. Till next week, bye.